Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I'm Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I design tabletop role-playing games, usually with a partner. And I'm here with my podcasting partner, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I am Craig Campbell. I am the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I mostly design on my own, but I have partnered on occasion to do things, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit. We have a really full boat today, so I'm going to throw this around to, let's see, who first? Alex, welcome back, Alex.
Hey, how's it going? I am the other half of Wannabe Games, and obviously there is a partnered theme coming up, so I am here.
And then we'll throw over to Sean, who is popping in here for the first time. Sean, hello.
Hey there. I'm Sean Drake. I am one half of a couple of Drakes Publishing. We also do indie tabletop roleplay games. And I'm also here with my partner.
Oh, that would be me.
I'm
Navi. I'm the other half of a couple of Drakes. I do all of the stuff that no one else wants to do.
By which, you know, I do 50% of the writing and ideation, and she does 50% of the writing and ideation and everything else that makes it a product. So.
You always need in a design partnership the person who does all of the other stuff.
Yeah.
You do need a person who can do that. So good on you. That's not me in the design. Like, I'll do editing, I'll do layout, and Alex is like literally everything else, including like make sure that we get stuff out on a deadline.
Right.
Do the rules.
She does the layout and art and stuff, and I have to do the marketing and the customer service. That's how it becomes a partnership, right?
Alex, sorry.
I was going to say, I do air quotes customer service because ours is a little like, you're fine. You see what we're doing. Let's not bother us, actually. So
you knew what this was when you got involved.
Yeah, Craig. So obviously we've brought all these people on today to talk about partnering up. You want to swing over to our GMing topic for the day?
Sure. And we've got a lot of people to talk about. We'll eventually get to talking about design partnerships, which is not surprising given the panel of experts we have on today. But for GMing, there's a similar kind of situation, which is co-GMing. Not everybody does it necessarily, but it is something that can help to alleviate some of the responsibility and stress and kind of extra work and everything that kind of comes out of GMing, that is kind of splitting it around, letting multiple, two or even more people GM. Sometimes that may even happen at the same time at the same table, but oftentimes it's more like one person will GM the game for a time and kind of wrap whatever story or whatever series of adventures they're doing there, and then somebody will take over, and so everybody gets a chance to play, and you've got multiple people that GM. So we're going to talk a little bit about what that looks like and how you might make that happen at your table with advice from people who are well versed in sharing responsibility.
Yeah, I've not, and we've talked about co-GMing before on the podcast. I don't have a lot of experience doing that. But I do have some. I have like a little bit, mostly being the player. What about you, Navi and Shane?
So I've seen the magic trick accomplished. I was in a long-term like D&D club when I was in college, where there was one guy who really just wanted to run monsters. And the other guy who wanted to create a big overarching story for why we were fighting those monsters. And then it was also probably the most comfortable I'd ever seen two GMs running both sides of a conversation between NPCs before. So anytime you have NPCs talking to each other, you have to kind of juggle their character voices and stuff. But it was almost like watching little mini skits anytime there were people arguing in front of us. But it ended in acrimony as they imagined divergent courses of how the world goes. So seeing two people run a single table at the same time, it was not just a player like, hey, help me run a monster or whatever. It looks like a challenge, I have ideas on how it might be accomplished, but let's.
Yeah, I think that when we play together, it's not so much co-GMing, so much as like assistant GMing, if I'm being perfectly honest. So he'll be GMing and I'm there to support the players, make sure the players have everything they need. Can they find what they're looking for? If there are supplementary rules they need looking up, I'm looking those up. I'm taking the notes so that he doesn't have to remember the game next week.
That's true.
So I'm running all of the errands required, would normally be required of a GM, but it lightens the GM's load and it makes the play at the table much smoother because we don't all have to like hit the brakes to help somebody with a mechanic. I can quietly help off at the center. So that's certainly a way that we handle it at our tables that works really well. It helps just to have someone there that knows the rules already. You don't even have to like call yourself a GM, just taking that role at the table, like, okay, look, I am going to be the assistant GM. And that's pretty close. But as far as co-GMing, we did used to run a significant number of play-by-post type of role plays. Those are written role plays. They move at a little bit of a slower pace. There's often a lot more going on. And during those, especially if we were playing in MMOs, because we were big MMO players, so we would do live events, but they were still a written format. That's when you would actually break off and he would be leading one event while I was leading another event, and we're kind of touching bases to make sure that both things are happening simultaneously. But because of how many people would appear at these events and how long it takes to formulate a post, you have hours and hours and hours of keeping everyone entertained and making sure that everybody has something to do. So that's why we would actually split up and have multiple events running simultaneously, because then people get to post much faster because they're not all waiting for one huge group to make their statements before they can make theirs. So that was our big experience with actual honest God co-GMing, where both of us were running events simultaneously, but it was in a written format, not in a speaking format, because when you're sitting down, it is much faster. Like you're just talking and you're rattling stuff off, and there's not actually a lot of room, at least at our table, for another GM to like really jump in, mostly because Sean is like, he's not human. I don't know how to It's not normal. The shit, he can think of things off the top of his head in real time and it comes out of his mouth and sounds great. I gotta think, that's why I'm a great writer, not a great fucking talker. So just like, I don't need to jump into that. I don't gotta put my foot in it. I don't have to open my mouth and make people like entertain people with my words. I can just let him go because he is phenomenal. Why would I want to hurt that?
Do we consider like a more writer's room aspect to a game being invitation toward like co-GMing?
Well, I was actually going to ask about that, because otherwise I don't have much co-GMing stuff, but when Jess runs games and goes, here's the plan, you're basically in on it, so we can get there in a good fashion, I'm always like very psyched.
Yeah.
I would say that's co-GMing, even if it's a little bit of a, you know, a hidden role.
Sure.
In that case, I'm establishing now that Forge in the Dark games are all co-GM games. Yeah. So five GMs at a table. He lied. John Harper lies to you when he says you only need one GM, because everybody has equal weight. Although you have to do more funny. He has to do more funny voices. So maybe that's the difference.
Well, different people bring different strengths. Yeah.
Well, some people are location scouts, right? Like engine and stunt coordinators, and some people like have more of like a costuming or props or whatever to ensure that there's, but at the end of the day, everybody gets a writer's credit on any game that I run anyway.
No, I really like that system that you were describing, where like an assistantship, it's not necessarily equal parts. And by the way, I'm sorry, I called you Shane. Your name is Sean. That's bad. Okay. I apologize. You should have corrected me.
That's all right. Sean, Shane, Drake, whatever.
Different names though, entirely. But I love that system you described, because like co-GMing, they don't need to be 50-50 equal parts. And if you try to be 50-50 equal parts, like there are going to be some, it's just like any other relationship, like you're not always going to be able to give that same effort forward and backwards every single time. There have to be moments where somebody takes on this task and this role and more, and somebody else can step back a little bit, re-energize, re-up, or like we can take our strengths, like you were describing, like your strengths with talking versus your strengths with writing versus your strengths with layout, editing, art, like all of those things. I mean, with GMing, like all of those things have to be balanced. I don't know. I feel like it also makes a much more rich game as well, like the writer's room style too. A game like that is a richer game because everybody is participating and everybody is like kind of taking on part of that load. So I think like especially the assistantship kind of GM role, I can see that working super, super well, especially in like a professional jamming setting. But also, I mean, if you have someone who's willing to do that at your regular table with your friends, like, you're lucky. That is a good partnership. That's great.
We've talked about like something similar to this on the show before, which was if you've got like, you know, there's a lot of different types of players at the table, and you may have a player at the table who's like super conversant with the rules and knows how to find stuff very quickly and is, you know, is able to convey information very clearly to people. And we've talked about that, like that player just kind of helping to take some of those, you know, take some of those responsibilities. And really what it is what we're talking about is co-GMing. They're in an assistantship position, even though they're still playing character and they may not know like where the story is going. You know, it's possible, like we've talked here, a couple of people mentioned like where the GM may say, hey, you know, this is kind of the direction we're heading. Let's make sure we kind of get there and don't get running off following red herrings all over the place. And everybody feels like we get done with the game and everybody feels like we've kind of wasted our time and not gotten anywhere. But you can do that and you don't have to do that. Like you can have it just be like, here's the things that this person excels at and they're willing to help with. And it can make the whole table run smoother. It's just a question of, you know, calling them a co-GM comes down to semantics almost.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Some games you even like, you need a co-GM, like big LARPs, you need a co-GM. You can't GM a LARP with a lot of people by yourself because the story's happening all over. There might be somebody over there who needs you, somebody over here who needs you. Like I used to play LARPs where like we'd have hundreds of people at a campground. Like you can't do that. It's just one GM. No. Like
one dude with a megaphone. just
like everybody function.
Need an auctioneer to do that.
Yeah. I mean, and yeah, definitely an auctioneer. Maybe everyone has walkie-talkies, but that's just untenable.
GM's on channel 3.
I've seen it in convention play too, sometimes with like really big interactives, what some RPGs will refer to as like the interactive, like this big where you've got multiple tables that are running at the same time, each with their individual GM, and they're all kind of doing their, you know, this leg of this story. They're all doing the same story, but there might be some meta element that kind of ties it all together. And there's somebody that's kind of managing all of that. And so they're kind of co-GMing everybody else's table. I played in a D&D event like that once where every table was people fighting an invasion, and we were all like in different parts of a castle, and there was the, you know, the baddies were coming and we were all having these giant fights, and there was a GM that was walking around with a giant model, you know, a giant mini of a dragon that was just swooping from battlement to battlement. They would have to come in and find out like, okay, what's going on with this group right now? You know, because the dragon's super smart. Dragon knows what's going on. Dragon is hearing everything that's happening. So that co-GM to everybody played it like, you know, have a quick talk with the GM here to figure out kind of what the lay of the land is with this group, and then pick the fight, figure out where the dragon's going to land, how it's going to attack, what it's going to do, if it's going to try to screw with the leader, if it's going to try to take out the healer, or if it's going to do whatever. And then it would fight, you know, the dragon would show up and fight for 2 or 3 rounds and then go to the next battlement as it just swooped around the city.
That's cool.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And it was a 4-hour game. And we're watching this because everybody got to know the guy, and we would see him just kind of slowly making his way around. And he's like, he's like at the table next to us. Like,
oh, no, here he comes.
We better deal with the immediate problem right now because we're about to have a much bigger problem.
That's fucking rad. Like, I love that conceptually. That's the coolest thing I think I've heard as far as like somebody doing something cool with D&D.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was a good time.
There was
I was just gonna ask Alex, that's kind of how they do Level Eater, right, here in Chicago?
Yeah, Level Eater is a charity event that we go to but don't actually like play the game of. We're just there to support, where they have like 12 tables at the same time technically running the same mission, but there is like a multiversal aspect to it where you can go to a big board and like put up clues on like how to handle like different adventure problems and like little puzzles. But what always ends up happening is that people will like come up with an accidental solution for a problem and then be like, make sure to check all the pies. And then people are like, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't help us at all. And causes as many problems as like not. But it's a, talking to Will Hindmarch, who puts it on, I was like asking the level of effort that goes into planning that. And he's like, I pretty much don't want to talk about it. It is so much that I, day of, am still writing down notes and trying to get things out to people and like do all this. And I'm like, yeah, it's not as easy as running 12 tables at once. It's like gets exponentially harder with like each like few more tables you put in, and it gets more and more complicated to keep them on track at the same time. So
yeah, yeah, I mean,
sometimes
expert level GMing,
I'm breaking out in hives just thinking about it.
I know, I was like, oh.
It takes a lot of effort, like a lot of communication. Like that's one thing you definitely have to have if you're co-GMing or partnering in any sort of way. You gotta have really strong communication and strong planning skills. So for sure.
And I did one time briefly, did the co-GMing thing where we passed the GMing around. We had a group of people, and one of the players, or the, you know, the GM was kind of like, oh, you know, I'd really love to play, but I don't want to stop this campaign because everybody's having so much fun with their characters and everything. And so I said, okay, well, how about I GM like, you know, a short stint of things for, and you can play. But that required us to have a discussion, and without him giving away too much to me, being just making it clear, like, okay, this is kind of generally where things are going. We got to make sure, you know, don't do anything that's going to like just derail everything that's going on. You know, I had to be very careful to not introduce, anything that might be, you know, problematic to the continuing story when he picks it back up. It's like, don't introduce particular types of, he gave me actually a list, was like, don't introduce these magic items, because there's gonna be a chance to earn these, but they have to happen in the story, you know. So otherwise you like, because some, you know, we all know if you play D&D enough, you know, there are some magic items that just solve your problem for you, like very powerful ones. Like you got a thing like, okay, oop, that's not a problem anymore. Like as soon as you can start removing curses, bestow curse isn't a problem anymore.
Right.
And you know, like no, like dropping like uber powerful anything in there. No, don't drop an artifact in the game.
Plus my Holy Avenger, I got it on Craig's table.
Yeah. So it was a bit of communication like that. And so we talked about it before I took over, and then we talked about it kind of midway through to make sure he was like, okay, I think, yeah, everything's fine. Just kind of keep doing as you're doing. And he was having fun playing and everything was cool. And we kind of wrapped this little side trick, like it was like 3 or 4 sessions of him being able to play. And then just shifted right back over to him. And I started up, you know, back into playing my character. And we wrote my character out. He went off and did something and leveled during that time at the same time the rest of the group did, and blah, blah, blah.
So forgive me, because I'm right now kind of Conan brained. I've gone through a big pulp rediscovery. So all the old 1930s, 1940s, like sword and sandal kind of stuff is all kicking around in my head. How cool would it be to play like a game like Microscope, and create like a big like world, and then everybody has their section of the world, and anytime like the core like cast moves to that section of the world, the GM switches.
That's me.
That would be very cool, assuming you've got a table full of people who are all comfortable GMing. Obviously.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you would absolutely need to have a table that would suit it. But man, I would love to get an all GMs all the time. Oops, all GMs game. And
well, oops, all GMs. No, I would one up you on that and say, let each section like have a slightly different flavor. Too,
yeah, no, absolutely.
Where like you go off, like we're gonna go over, when we go into this section, it's all political intrigue, yada yada, you know, and we go into this one and it's all, you know, like there's a war going on and you're thrust into the middle of it. Because one of the things I you know, as I often do, I think about terms and think about things in terms of TV shows and movies. Yep. Is like, I love a TV show where it reinvents itself every season or every couple seasons. Or where they go on a sidetrack that's just so incredibly different from anything they've dealt with before. It still feels like that show, But like, you know, when Angel, when they all go to Pylea and they leave Earth and they're gone for several episodes where they're in this weird world where the, these demons live, and it there's a whole storyline that takes another direction. They introduce a new character that's going to become a regular. They do all this stuff, and they did it. It was necessitated by the fact that Buffy was going to die. And in the other storyline with the other with the other show, so like, well, we'll get, because Angel would go to help her if she was going up against something really terrible, so we have to get Angel out, so let's take them and just throw them all into this other dimension for four episodes. And it was like, it's one of the best parts of Angel when it really shifts tone.
You could even switch game set, like,
yes!
rules, right?
Oh, no.
Sean's
no,
all
no,
in.
No, you don't understand. This has been a conversation, and I needed to stop now before it goes any further.
I'm kind of on Sean's side here. So
she's been hearing about the game, right? Like, the white whale, holy grail game in which everything starts, like, Beyond the Wall or Stone Top, where you're like kids in a village and like you're defending your village against weird stuff, and like it, the call to adventure, and now all of a sudden you're playing Knave or whatever, as you're like having the first like, oh my god, this is real, it's getting dark and it's getting gritty, but you know, we establish like what's broken at the heart of the world, and now we're playing Chasing Adventure or Fellowship, or no, we need to pull back and like look at the greater context, so instead we're playing Kingdom, or we're playing Microscope, or whatever, right? Or we've gone to the City of Adventure, now we're playing Court of Blades, or whatever. I'm sure she's tired of hearing about it, but this is the first time for y'all, so the grand game, it starts from like the smallest of narrowest of scopes and expands and blooms out to something huge like that. That is, thank you for having the same brain as me, Jessica. That's great.
No, I mean, I think that would be so, it would be so fun to do. It would be so hard to pull off, but like, gosh, isn't that the dream? Like, I feel like, isn't that what everybody wants out of a tabletop role-playing game, right?
Forever, yes.
I was thinking of the exact opposite of that, where just everyone's playing a different rule set with their character, of just like, like, yeah, I'm playing like a mech commander, in this is a barbarian, and this is like a Victorian chancellor, and we're going on an adventure. I have only d12s, let's go. And
I mean, that would also be sick. I would also like that. We're getting innovative. I want to play that was our old segment.
I'm trying to think how I would adjudicate that, like, okay, you I guess make a lore check, and you make a will save, and you roll plus cool, and you
you would have to be the absolute master of a lot of game systems, really, and be able to keep that all straight in your head. But
okay, but
knowing Alex a little bit, I actually don't doubt you could pull that off at least one time. You might find yourself wanting to never ever do it again.
I would need some ringers in there, like, bringing some easy games in for me.
You're gonna be in the same room with Will Hindmarsh, and both of you are just gonna be like drinking, like, why did we ever do this to ourselves?
They say they want to play again.
Oh, God. They want a campaign.
That's actually, see, that would be a good charity event, is the five people playing the game get to bring whatever book they want, and I have to run a game with all five of them. Just showing up and like me studying for 20 minutes, just like, oh no.
Get ready for the weirdest, most obscure list of games that people are going to pull, their favorite out of print, discontinued, was never really popular in the first place, but they fell in love with it.
Broken rule set. That's
I've
like the
four,
pie in the
do
face
right
or dunk tank charity.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Well, we're already designing games. We want to start talking about designing games and partnerships.
Seems right.
Nice, clean segue.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically all I do. Almost every game. I mean, even the games I've designed, quote unquote, solo, Alex has had input in them in some way. I gotta have somebody to bounce ideas off of. like for me, my creative process works. If I was stuck in a cabin by myself for a year, I would probably have nothing done because I wouldn't have anybody to tell me if my idea was good or not. So I really like having that, like when I design with a partner, somebody to like reflect with, somebody to give me ideas, to grow off of my ideas, to tell me if an idea sucks. Like that's the most valuable thing for me with a design partner. I don't know how the two of you feel about that.
You go. You can go first.
You want me to go first? God. Okay. So I never stop having ideas. I am a fire hose of this would be really cool. We should do this. Hey, there's this thing. I've been reading this thing. I've been watching this thing. I think that if we slam the two of them together, they have kind of like melted down into a cool compost. Here is an idea. And she's like, great, write it down. Because your idea is worth absolutely nothing. Until I can look at it, until I can read it, and I can see like in black and white what it is that you mean. Your reckless enthusiasm is not a product. Like that is not a thing that anybody can use.
That's not an aggressive. I'm not making it like, hey, you make me a product.
No, but that's right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
She needs a pitch, right? She needs me to actually like, because I will. I'll like an excited hamster with his wheel in the shop, like just bounce from thing to thing. Like, this is really cool. You should look at this. Hey, well, what do you think about this? And she's like, write it down. Let me read it. Let me analyze it. And that does make you sound.
I'm going to say this right now for the record. I absolutely love the phrase reckless enthusiasm. That is spectacular. That's going to become part of my lexicon going forward.
Hell yeah. Good.
That's more how I feel about some things. Mm. I get really, really enthusiastic and I get recklessly enthusiastic and I start designing, developing ideas and I kind of bullet point it out like what can be. And sometimes it just goes womp womp and never becomes anything because you realize that the enthusiasm is all there was.
Enthusiasm will carry you the first 10%.
You can't translate it into something. You can't, but sometimes you can translate it into something. Yeah.
Yep. Where was I going? Right. So when the pitch is down, she says that my job is to make it fun and easy to run. Hers is to make it fun and easy to play. And that's kind of how we divide labor for the first part of ideation and creation, I think. Mm-hmm. Does that track to you?
I mean, it depends on the project. Sure. That's often the way it goes. Jam games are usually a little bit different because we'll just spitball things back and forth and I'll take notes while we're talking. But yeah, when he comes to me with a preconceived idea that I was not part of the formulation of, he made it sound really awful, but I'm going to tell you, there's a reason why I'm like, you have to write it down so I can read it. I'm not a verbal person. I'm just not. I don't know. It's my particular brand of tism. I don't do verbal very well. If I can read it, then I can immediately understand. I can grok it if I can read it. But if you say it to me, it's like through my head and out the other side. I don't know what it is. And then I'll forget it. That's the worst part. My memory is so bad. I don't remember what I said 5 minutes ago. So, you know, don't trust me with your ideas. That's why the write it down thing, because I wasn't writing it down when you thought of it.
It's said with love every time. But
yeah, I know that sounds so familiar to me.
I think we have 4 or 5 games actively being like, you know, formulated that right now are like, you remember the idea about the cursed game? And then like, well, yeah, but we don't have any of the details of what we talked about written down for that, so we're gonna have to make it from start again.
That's not true. They're in my notes app. That one is.
Okay. I was driving. I remember specifically, so I couldn't write it down. But stuff like that. And I'm like, I think there's like several games that were good ideas that we have just not made because we forgot to write them down at some point. And I'm like, man, that's a bummer.
Well, we have several that we've gotten to like a sticking point where I am just not a smart enough game designer yet. Mm-hmm. To push it that past that like 70% mark. The part where you kind of fall out of love with it, right? Like, but very often, like Navi is the impetus. Like when I hit those blocks, she'll say something innocuous, and it will be brain unlocking. It breaks like the vapor lock of the creative process, and it makes things easier. Which is why I need you to reread Dark Bargain, please.
Oh.
Write that down, Navi.
Forget. When it comes down to it too, though, like when you're working with another person, you're working with two brains now instead of just one. I mean, our human brain is so like we're little computers all the time, just going. You get two of them together, like your capacity has just exponentially increased. And I'm like, I think it is really, how am I going to say this without sounding a little bit mean? I can tell if somebody has written something and then they've had no feedback from anybody. Everyone's nodding. They're not agreeing with me and yes. And this audio podcast.
But yeah, I'm sorry. Complete agreement. Yeah.
That everyone's agreeing with me here. Okay, good. I felt mean kind of saying that.
No, because for brains, yeah. Getting more brains on a project, getting more feedback on a project, like it's not a linear arithmetic. Well, I guess mm-hmm. it kind of is. It's multiplicative rather than additive, right? Because mm-hmm. the way more people will read it, it'll help clean up the language, it'll break down what's that called in English where there is it's fuzzy, it's
barrier? Not
clear. Like it makes something more, it improves the clarity mm-hmm. of the prose and the mm-hmm. And the instructions, right? So
right.
It is always good to have more brains look at a thing and help sand down the sharp corners.
Oh, and I take that shit so seriously. Anytime somebody gives feedback, I pick up my book, I'm grabbing it, if it's on the computer, then I'm flipping through the page, I'm like, okay, where's the section that they're stuck on? Is it me or is it them? Because sometimes on occasion, it's just, no, it's there, but they missed it. That's fine. Here's where you find the information. But sometimes it's like, oh shit, it's missing. I forgot to put it there because I knew what I meant.
Right.
But you can't look into my head.
And you've been designing this thing for however long. So in mm-hmm. your head, everything's clear. Everything's all there. And like that happens to me so many times. Like I didn't even say this word that I'm referencing later. Like I need to go back. Somebody needs to look at this.
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument for editing in general.
Yeah.
And you know, what you're doing is sort of story and developmental editing. Like yeah. without it being formalized by like a freelancer or something, you've got a partner who's going to sit down and look at that stuff. Like I primarily work alone on that stuff, but for the thing I'm working on right now, for Cosmic Corsairs, which is the first, hopefully, of a series of games that are all kind of set in the same solar system, the same world, as it were. And there was a lot of, I want all the games to be cross compatible with each other and the story stuff, like what's presented in each game book that's specific to that particular kind of a game also makes sense with the rest of the game, with the other games. I like this time around, I hired somebody on specifically. He's my friend Chris is getting a story developer added a credit. And like we've had long conversations about like doing this at having this little bit that's going to hearken to something that's coming in a future game. This little thing, I got, okay, well, I've set this thing up. So I got to make sure that gets developed down the road. And now he's got a list and he's going to be the story developer on every game. Chris, if you're listening, I don't know if you realize that, but that's the plan.
You're spoken for now.
I think he does. But that put him in the position of, you know, questioning a lot of my choices. And asking, well, why are we doing, why are you doing this like this? What's this all about? Is there something I'm missing? Blah, blah, blah. And just suggesting things that I wouldn't have thought of, because I know that happens all the time. I've had, one of the reasons I've hired freelancers to do setting work is I know, like, I'm always afraid that I'm going to be like, oh, the setting, everything kind of sounds like everything else, because there wasn't another imagination involved. Another person's mind going, hey, what about something yeah. that I wouldn't necessarily think of? And so having, you know, working in a partnership to start with puts you in the position of getting that stuff in place faster.
Yeah, and it can be, depending on how you design, how your brain works, it can be a huge benefit to work with a partner. I tend to be very analytical. I mean, we just recently were working through a mechanic for a game that hinges on mini games, and we had to come up with a mini game for combat. And he gave his WAG first, and I was like, and I took it to the table because I play test everything with myself. And I took it to the table. I'm like, I fucking hate this. This is miserable. I don't want to do this much math. I was like, let me take a WAG at it. So I took a WAG at it, and it was very, it was very perfectly balanced. It was a lot of arithmetic, and it worked very well. But at the end, he was like, that's so stale. So then we came together finally, and like the first half of how I decided combat should work ended up making it in. And then the second half of how he had originally wanted combat to work made it back in. And we moved forward with what was a really strong mechanic where it began as two mechanics that we didn't like at all.
Now it's both balanced and flavorful.
Put that on the front of the book.
Blurb worthy.
There's where you can kind of fall into one of the pitfalls of working with a partner too, is you have to know how to take criticism for something that you really personally like and that the other person does not like. Mm-hmm. I think like in our relationship, because Alex is also my husband, in our relationship, the most times we've ever had arguments has been over game design. Like how are we going to handle this? And like, you have to really learn, you have to really know how to take criticism, take feedback, implement that feedback without having feelings hurt, you know, like that can be tough for some people. I mean, definitely. I think it has worked out well for us. Like, we know how to argue without being mean to each other.
Yeah. Argue without fighting.
Alex is still your husband, so.
Yeah,
yeah, we're not divorced yet. No.
Wow.
We're fairly good, but it's not quite fair because I am unoffendable.
Yeah.
So if I do something, he's like, I don't like that. And I'm like, well, fucking fix it then. What are you talking to me for?
I'm hearing a lot of complaints. I'm not hearing a lot of solutions. Well, okay then. I guess I'll sit down and do work then.
See, yeah, that also really works. Like, I've seen it happen before in teaching too. Like, co-teachers are a thing. And like the co-teachers who don't work well together are when you have one person who doesn't know how to take criticism and the other person who wants to give feedback, and then they just clash and they don't understand why they hate each other at the end.
Yeah.
And that sucks. That sucks for everyone involved, and it produces a worse classroom. And the same thing happens for design partners. You have one person who is super attached to their ideas and doesn't actually want to work with somebody else. And the other person who does, like, that's where the worst feelings can start brewing over. I haven't seen that specifically in game design, but I've definitely seen it in teaching.
They don't produce product.
it just stops. It just explodes.
I've heard many horror stories of partnerships being dissolved because they just didn't work well together. And I'm like, well, yeah, did you plan it? Like, I guess me and Jess originally didn't plan out how we'd make games, but now we go into every game and like kind of divvy up parts of it and like know where we're going to be working. So it took a while to get there.
It does. It is a skill set. Like,
no, absolutely.
Don't let anybody tell you that just because it is kind of a freewheeling art form, that it is not a skill set that needs to be, it's a muscle that needs to be worked out. That's a skill set that needs to be refined.
I actually applaud people who solo design because I couldn't fucking do it. I couldn't get like from beginning to end and then feel confident and then put it out into the world. Like, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do anything. I would do absolutely nothing if it was me by myself designing games.
Similar. I've had plenty of ideas before Navi came along, but I had not published anything.
Yeah. Same. I mean, I wrote adventures. That was like what I would do.
Nice.
Didn't write games until Alex was like, hey, actually, I think we should do this.
Yeah. We could do this. And here you are doing it.
Maya, I had a question, though, of we've talked about all the positives, but I'm always worried of like losing the kind of stylistic voice that like we try to put into games when it's even just us editing each other's stuff and we like argue for like, no, that's not unclear. That's like a style choice. I want that in. And it's why I'm like, I'm very nebulous about like design by committee stuff, because I think it loses a lot of like voice if everyone there is not like understanding exactly what we're going for. But do you guys ever worry about the like, I want this to have this feel, and when we edit and we have different voices, it's going to maybe take off the edge that we wanted?
I think this is very much like most of the conversations we've been having about partnering anything. It's really, really beneficial for someone to know when and where it's their responsibility to take the backseat, to not be the strong voice in the room. So when it comes to games with tone and whatnot, I married this man because of his writing ability. We met in a writing forum. So His writing is what, like his tone and how he uses words is what attracted me to him. So whenever it's time to start something, like, you lay down the tone first and then I follow his lead on that. But once it is written and it's finished, he trusts me. My job as the analytical one is I'm going to tear it apart and make sure it's legible. Like, can a normal person who does not read prose and whatnot still understand the core underlying? Because this is a game. You have to be able to play it at the end of the day. So beautiful words are not enough to carry it. You have to be able to understand this simply as well as have beautiful words. So I come in and sometimes I will take a couple sentences and I'll be like, and I'll let them know. I'm like, these are the ones, these are getting reworded because this is not clear to people.
Yep.
And so it works, again, that works really, really well for us. And because we're completely different styles, I write very clearly, very concisely. I don't write artistically, and he writes really beautifully and really artistically. So my job is just to clean it up and make sure that everyone can understand it.
Point of contention there. She does write beautifully, but she writes clearly. I will bring a sonnet with dice notation, put it in front of you and say, now play. And she's like, you can't do that. This needs mechanics. You need to explain what these mechanics do. Like, you know. You've named it. It's got a great evocative name, this mechanic, but they're not going to understand it. So please tell me what you mean so that I can write it so that people can read it.
Not unless they'll only understand it if they know the difference between a Shakespearean and an Italian sonnet.
Yeah, is this a Petrarchan? Is this a Petrarchan sonnet? What are we doing? Yeah, exactly. No, I only need two lines to finish the thematic variance. Thank you.
That's a sonnet joke, everybody. Everybody loves a good sonnet joke.
That's a deep cut, Monseigneur. Yes, there are challenges. I think I could not write. I don't think I could write with anybody else. Because we have a near telepathic understanding of each other. We undermean what the other one stands really, really quickly without a whole lot of coaching. I think that kind of thing can happen over time. But from the very, as she said, we met in a writer's forum. So we were familiar with the way we worked. We were familiar with our timelines. We were familiar with all of the idiosyncrasies of our creative processes. Before we started writing together. Mm-hmm. I think that is incredibly, that put us ahead of the curve for like any other partnership, mm-hmm. knowing how to work around each other and how to collaborate effortlessly, seamlessly. Then every now and then processes break down, but if you can maintain a 70% average, that's already huge, huge leaps ahead.
I think that's very obviously why so many design partnerships that I know of are married couples. Like, these are people who already have an established relationship. They know each other really well. And they have other reasons to not completely break down this design partnership. Maybe their familial relationship. I'm trying to think of design partners in games specifically. I know a couple design partners in games that are not like in a partnership as well, but they are also, you know, people who really understand each other and have known each other for a long time.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
They're people who have been friends forever, or they were family through marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And knew each other for a long time and kind of had same interests, and then eventually kind of, you know, and I think that probably, you know, that's maybe how the starting up the partnership kind of comes about, is like, well, we know each other very, very well. We know like each other's design sensibilities, mm-hmm. or games that we each like, or how we write or whatever. And then that's the common ground that you use to kind of launch from there. Whereas coming in cold and saying like, okay, I've got one person who really loves to write setting and lore and descriptive prose and stuff, and one person that's like super crunchy and loves the rule kind of stuff. Well, that's great. Those are two things that you want in the game, but can they kind of mesh that? Mm-hmm. And that becomes an experiment if they're kind of starting cold, and it may work and it may not.
there's kind of an intimacy of ideas that has to happen. You have to have a, you have to be able to be open and vulnerable with each other if you're going to like have that kind of intimacy of ideas. You find that, you know, very rarely in people who just, oh, we, you know, bumped into each other a couple times, had a, had an idea that sounded cool to the both of us.
I mean, I've designed little tiny games with like the Unpub, what is it? What is that event called where you're just designing a game from?
It's just a jam game.
Yeah, the game jam. I've done that before, but like, I don't feel like that's as sustainable. Like, you definitely do need to have a trust with the other person. Because like I said before, you have to know how to take critiques from somebody and give critique to somebody without damaging that relationship, which not everyone can do.
Sure.
Then I think like what, one in 20 ideas I mentioned to you is something that we start on, maybe. Like most ideas are kind of bad. Like that's something people like a lot of people don't like talking about that, but like most game ideas, like, ah, no one's gonna want this. Yeah. And also deciding, is this a game for only us, or would anyone else in the world want to play this?
Sometimes having a game for only you is fun.
Sometimes I do that. I go into it knowing I'm like, nobody's gonna like this game, but I'm gonna fucking love this game, and that's totally valid. But and I actually think that's extremely important, not even from a partnership perspective, but from a personal artist perspective, is remembering to do the things that gave you joy just because they give you joy. Because if everything at the end of the day turns into, can I turn this into a saleable product, I cannot think of any faster way to burn out your love of anything ever.
Designed for you first, right? Yeah. It's great if there are some other people who might want that, if it follows a trend or things like that, but do not let trend be your boss.
Yeah. Gosh.
Another type of game I talk about a lot, which is game designer games, which is every game designer is like, this is the coolest idea ever. It will never sell to other people.
Because there's five of us. Yeah. There's five of us out there.
If you are not obsessed with game design, you will not care about the ideas in this game at all. But right now, I think it's the coolest thing ever made.
Yeah. Exactly. I think game designer games might be best expressed as things that make other game designers go, oh, right.
Yeah.
I refer to the ones that are purely like for me as like my trash games, right? Like I love the idea of this. I love the fantasy of sitting down and playing this. Will I be able to get five other human beings to sit down and play this with me? Probably not, but maybe there are a couple other little freak goblins out there who want to play this with me.
Oh, I tell plenty of jokes that have no audience except for me. They're only for me to laugh. So I do that plenty of times. Sometimes I tell jokes just to annoy other people. Sometimes I design games just to annoy other people.
Look, it's good for the soul. It's good for the soul.
It's like the most valid thing that's been said this whole time.
Yeah, we can wrap it up now. We're not getting better than that.
Yeah, I think the worst feedback I've ever gotten on one I was working on by myself was just saying, like, you have quoted Leonard Cohen too many times in this game. You have to stop. And I was like, okay, let's
okay,
true.
Respectfully, that's
you have
not
to
possible.
Understand that there was a secret chord.
All right, what final thoughts? I usually bounce this over just to like our one guest that we have on, but what our final thoughts are. But we have three guests on, so what's something that hasn't been said that you want to finish our episode with?
On partnerships? Anything?
Be choosy with who you partner with. Like,
oh no, that is so true. In any partnership, I mean, it really is. If you're already married, that helps, but otherwise it is like a marriage. Like, you need to know how to problem solve. You need to be able to problem resolve. Like, don't go to bed angry. Like, don't walk away from the game design like room like, fuck you and I'm leaving. Like, you've got to be strong communicators and like know who's good to when to take a backseat, give and take. Like, it's any other relationship, if you are not prepared to give and take, somebody's going to be extremely unhappy, or it's going to just explode and die,
and it's going to show in the work either way.
That's so true.
Absolutely.
Alex? Oh, do I get one too? Yeah. You looked at me. This is my, I'm pushing this to everyone because I've learned it's not a norm. Start making design documents for your games so you know what you have left to make. I've learned that most people don't do this, and I think especially for people working with other people, it wastes so much time trying to figure out what you're supposed to be doing when you sit down every day to work on it. So, you know, just use a template.
If you've never heard of a Kanban board, go look up Kanban board, because that is how I handle everything that has to have more moving parts, extra people. I get the entire team on the exact same channel. It's basically like, these are things that need to get done right now. These things need to get done later. And this is the finished pile. And this is the, we'll get to it eventually pile. That and works. Your job is to make things move from this pile to this pile. And we're all going to work together to do that. It's the best system ever.
That board mocks me.
The to-do list is like 20 miles long. Look at that. Just grab one thing and move it down the line.
And that style of boards, you can do that on Trello, like that. We use that for a while. The problem with us is that if it's not in our face, we kind of forget about it. But it lets you have the solo work while you are working in your group, because you aren't always going to be able to only design when you are sitting down with this other person that you're designing with. There are going to have to be times where you're doing this stuff on your own. And I think that's kind of like the crutch of what you guys are.
That's an interesting point. I would actually say that, with the exception of ideation, we exclusively work alone.
Yep.
And then like we peg each other, like, hey, I need you to look at this or help me figure out this problem. But it's not actually us side by side working on the same paragraph at the same time. Like, it's a total opposite of that. You got jobs, I got jobs.
Until we hit a stumbling block. Yeah. Then we go ahead together.
Yeah.
Exactly like how we do it too. We do that ideation together, work separately, stumbling block, come back together, and then we do a final read through together.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say, get a lot more work done when we're in the same room working on different things, which I don't know why. I just like it feels like the correct time to be working.
Yeah.
But
it's office hours.
Yeah.
Oh, there's something to be said for being in the right environment. And if you are in the room with the other person who's working on design stuff, your design partner, even if they're working on something very different, completely different game, you're both kind of sharing that creative environment just by the sake of the fact that you're both in the room creating at the same time.
That's when the gods come down and shine upon you and bring you their energies. You have to be in the right spot.
I forgot that. Interventions.
Throwing the muses at you.
Yeah, we didn't mention the muses. I mean, get a muse. Obviously, everyone knows how to do this. Everyone knows how to call upon the gods, but we don't need to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
No one gets ideas. You're just given them. Nothing is owed to you. That's right. Yeah. This is a thing all game designers believe.
We learned it at game designer school, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like the sleepaway camp that we all go to.
Yeah, it was a religious school.
I didn't have a school but I did go. I do go to the secret meetings.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Where they teach these things. Yeah.
You were homeschooled. That's fine. We do still accept it.
Oh, he's one of those red trim robe guys. Yes, we all know about them.
I am so wealthy.
Thanks, everyone, for being on today. This has been a lot of fun. We'll start with the drinks. Where can we find your stuff?
You can find us at acoupleofdrakes.com. It's going to forward you straight to acoupleofdrakes.itch.io, which is where we keep all of our games. Sorry, my water bottle is making a squealy sound, which is where we keep all of our games. And if there's any game that interests you and you click on it, you'll be able to see if it is available in hardcover, if it is available in softcover, and if it's going to be, or if it's on Kickstarter. That's always at the top. So like anytime you're interested in a project, but we have a lot of ash cans on there and stuff, which is wonderful. You go play games that are still in play testing, which is like the coolest time to play a game, because you can actually get in and make, you know, offer input that makes changes in the future. And that's pretty much the best way to contact us. We are on Blue Sky.
A couple of drakes at a couple of drakes dot blue sky dot social.
Alex?
I'm not on social media anymore. You can always join our Wannabe Smart Games Discord. and I don't know. Email me directly because I don't care. I can.
Hell yeah.
There's plenty of people who do that about game stuff. Or message me on Discord. I'm Kitty Crusade there.
I am on Blue Sky at Joska. You can also find our games at wannabegames.com, which is where you can also find a link to join our Discord if you wanted to.
Awesome.
And I'm Nerdburger Craig on various social media. The website is nerdburgergames.com, and the games are at DriveThruRPG. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avail by Steph Sachs, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sachs, and thank all of you for listening, and we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye.